For this episode, we've partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another sizzling hot episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored, where we dive into the most salacious details of, in this case, endometriosis. So I'm very obedient. I'm one of your hosts from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas. I am joined by my two sensationally statistically significant partners, Dr. Abby Eblen from Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
I love being statistically significant.
Doesn't everybody?
I've never been described with those adjectives. So that means our P is less than
0.05.
0.05.
Yes. Yes. And given the conversation we were just having about toilets and how all of them blocked.
Off the air, we were talking about toilets a minute ago.
Probably good.
When I said that, I'm like, that didn't really come out quite right, but oh well.
The statistician in our office thinks that the Super Bowl should have had not only a winner, but a winner where the score was statistically significant. So it wasn't just the outcome based on whenever the game stopped. It was they had to have enough of a difference in score so that you really knew that the winning team was actually winning and not just a random...
Just luck.
Of luck.
I'm getting a deeper appreciation for Forrest.
Well, you should. He is a wonderful man who is very special indeed.
But, you know, something like that in Vegas, a lot of money was won and lost on that one score. So I don't think most people would agree with that that assessment or that way of doing things for the Super Bowl.
So the casinos might actually, because the fact that it went into overtime meant that the loss that the casinos took was actually really pretty hefty because...
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No,
because however the odds were set, it was much more favorable if one team or the other won, not if they went into overtime.
Oh wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
So the casinos were just losing money right and left, huh? I'm sure they're making money right and left too, but
they only got like 9 million from that game.
1 billion probably.
Wow.
Yeah. It's special. I live in a unique place. It's wonderful.
It is a special place.
I ran the strip on a couple nights ago for a half marathon. And
did you say you ran and stripped?
It really did. You paused in a very interesting place, Carrie.
Yeah, it sounded like you ran and stripped. So do tell.
I mean, it's called Strip at Night. And so I ran the strip at night, but it's really cool because they shut down all of Vegas Boulevard.
You did that last year too, didn't you?
I did. And
did you do anything differently this year than you did last year?
Oh no, didn't train again because I am yet again a moron.
So how do you do that, Carrie? I mean, there's no way I could run 13 point whatever it is miles, 13.2. Is that what it is?
13.1. Yeah.
13.1. There's no way I could do that and not train for that. There's no way. And I mean, I feel like I'm in decent shape. It's not like I don't exercise, but I don't think I could do that. How do you do that?
I bet you could. I mean, I wasn't
walking any time. Did you walk some of it or did you run all of it?
Mm-hmm. No, I walked some of it. I got a foot cramp about mile six or so. And that's the first time I've ever had one of those, despite having run for quite some time. And it's, it did not feel good. Do not recommend.
Yeah, I bet it didn't.
0 stars.
So don't you know that like people like tear like major tendons and ligaments by like, you know, doing, you know, not that you don't exercise, but just going out and running 13.1 miles?
Yep. I have heard that. Mm-hmm. I have actually active enough. So even though I didn't train, it was like, we've got a lot of national parks close by. And so we do it for hiking. So,
okay. So you're in good shape then.
I wasn't too worried about it because 13 miles is not crazy. And knowing that I wasn't going to run all of it really helped.
Pretty crazy. It's pretty hard. It's not easy.
I am in awe as a non-runner. So
yeah,
I've run 3 half marathons, but I've trained a lot for them and they were not easy. By about mile 9, you're like going, okay, just a few more miles left.
So the sad thing is my time is not all that different when I train versus when I don't train.
It's probably safer, Carrie.
That, no arguments. No arguments. I am without a doubt dumb. I do not recommend this for anybody. But
well, let's let your brain cells shine and let's do some questions.
All right, let's do that.
Let's do them.
We're going to focus on endometriosis today. And so we're going to dive in and learn all the things.
Okay. So our first question, I love your podcast. I found it so helpful. Thank you so much. I have several questions that you may be able to address. Recently diagnosed with endometriosis with an endometrioma on ultrasound. I can't believe how little we still understand about this disease. My RE says it's not related to the immune system and I don't need an immune protocol. However, everything I'm reading on PubMed, not Google, suggests it is associated with dysregulation of the immune system. I have seen some clinics using low-dose naltrexone to treat the inflammation associated with endo. Could this be helpful?
Like a non-steroidal, she's saying? Anti-inflammatory?
Naltrexone is the anti-opioid.
Oh, yeah. Drug. Never heard of that.
So I've been seeing this more and more. Quite honestly, I only see it from people who have been to reproductive immunologists. I don't think that naltrexone is mainstream amongst reproductive endocrinologists at this point in time. I mean, I understand that there is absolutely an argument that endometriosis does have an immunological component. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't exist. So
you
have ectopic tissue or tissue that's not supposed to be in whatever place it is for some reason. I still think that probably if you're trying to treat endometriosis, I think, you know, the mainstays of either surgery or medical management with things like Orlissa or Lupron are better mainstays than necessarily naltrexone. Naltrexone, I don't think is, I mean, though it's a fantastic medication for a lot of things, I don't think that I'm quite on that bandwagon. What about
you? I don't understand that mechanism of action, why you would even use it. Maybe you can speak to this, Susan, since you've had patients with this, but it's an opioid antagonist. So why would that help? Even something that's immune, why would that be helpful? I don't understand why you even think to use it. Maybe there's something, I don't know. What do you know, Carrie?
So as I'm kind of pulling it up and looking at it, it looks like it's more of use in chronic pain disorders, which definitely implicates endometriosis. Yeah. Because that's chronic pain, where it modulates neuroinflammation and specifically the release of inflammatory chemicals in the central nervous system. And so if that happens more at the very low doses that we see with naltrexone use, I could kind of see where it's the beginning of making sense, but there's couple things to think of here.
You're not keeping the endometriosis from being there, which is why surgery or Lupron or Alyssa help. You're stopping it upstream versus this is kind of right before the chemicals get released that make you have pain.
Yeah, this
sounds like it's more for pain relief than it is anything else, maybe.
Well, I could see where if it blocks the actual inflammatory neuromodulators, that by blocking that, it prevents some of the subsequent reaction that makes it a little bit harder for implantation to occur, things like that. But this to me sounds like, and same with steroids, like steroids have been used forever in cycles. Right. Nobody has found any real conclusive, definitive, data-driven evidence that it helps. People use it a lot because the logic of it fits of, oh, we're going to stop this inflammatory process from happening. But the actual function of it hasn't been proven to be really beneficial. And there are distinct downstream effects of it. And so I don't know. It's very much not mainstream. That's for sure.
More studies needed.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds like just not great for mainstream endometriosis right now.
All right. Our next one. Is there anything you can do for adenomyosis when Lupron suppression doesn't seem to work? I've had 3 failed transfers of PGTA normal embryos, 1 with a 9-week miscarriage, 2 blighted ovums. All 3 were following 3 months of Lupron suppression. I did have stage 4 endo excised, and I see a reproductive immunologist, but I haven't had any serious problems there, just slightly elevated NK cells, which are managed by medication. I've never gotten pregnant naturally despite trying for 11 years. Age 35, all levels look normal. I'm interested in embryo adoption, but my clinic says I'm ineligible due to my 3 failed transfers and that my only option is a carrier, which is too expensive for me.
So with adenomyosis, some of the surgeons that I've worked with have commented that there can be channels that communicate from the adeno into the endometrium. And so what they have done in cases where they just don't see any response to Lupron is they have gone in to ablate those channels and close them off. Now, that's always kind of a risky thing to do because you don't want to damage the endometrium in the process. But I've definitely seen surgeons do that. And then the other thing to consider is that when you've got a discrete area of adeno, there are some procedures that I'm seeing more and more where the surgeon will take it out and will do kind of this uterine wrapping procedure where they reinforce the walls. They take out the area that's affected and they reinforce the wall in that location. So that would depend on a pretty skilled, minimally invasive gynecology surgeon who's familiar with those types of procedures, because that's not, you don't see that everywhere. That's just for the guys who live and breathe laparoscopic surgery.
And I would say too, with Lupron, when it first came out, I don't think people really use it this way much anymore, but for treatment of endometriosis, a lot of times it was a 6-month course of Lupron. And I think 3 months, you just barely get downregulated at 3 months. If it were me, I would try Lupron for the full 6 months, which is the way it really was initially developed to use. And people will get pretty downregulated by about the 3rd month is when people start to have symptoms of hot flashes, which suggests that they're downregulated. But I would try it, you know, for 3 more months even after that, because I think that would have a much better response to that than just 3 months of Lupron.
I agree. Good deal. Our next one. I recently discovered your podcast and I'm thoroughly enjoying listening it to my work commute. Thank you for listening. Yay. I'm 32, husband's 42. We've been pregnant 3 times, have 2 children, and miscarriage 2 years ago. We haven't been able to conceive again since the miscarriage. We've been at the fertility clinic for 1 year and moving to IVF next month. All testing has been normal other than a laparoscopy hysteroscopy 4 months ago. I had endometriosis, a cyst, and a polyp removed. My question is related to Receptiva test, Lupron suppression, when we get to FET. Are these things I should be asking my RE about since we know I have endometriosis, or is the surgery alone sufficient? I have heard and read different things, but wondering your opinions. Thank you.
Go for it, Abby.
So surgery actually is a very valid way to treat endometriosis. I think when the Receptiva assay was first developed, it question like, can we actually treat it medically? And interestingly ago, we used to think that if you treat somebody with Lupron, it's not as good as actually going in surgically and resecting it. So I think it's every bit as good as Lupron and maybe even a little bit better than Lupron. So if somebody's going to go in and resect your endometriosis, I think that will fix the issue. You know, you could always do a Receptiva biopsy at some point, but if you just want to know, I think you're going to have a more definitive treatment if you do surgery. And I don't know that you necessarily need to do that.
My biggest concern is the time difference between when you actually end up doing your IVF cycle and plan on doing your embryo transfer compared to your surgery. You had surgery 4 months
ago. Yeah, that's a good point.
So if you're getting close to that year mark, we know that a lot of endometriosis recurs within 1 year if it's going to recur. And instead of going in and having another surgery at that point, if you're getting close to that mark, I would highly recommend just getting a Receptiva done. If it's negative, go for your transfer. If it's positive, then consider Lupron or Alyssa.
So I didn't think that the Receptiva was going to particularly change, because you wouldn't expect 100% of the endometriosis to go away with surgery, right? Because there's always microscopic disease. So if you test it again, knowing that you got endometriosis on a surgery roughly 1 year ago, and you haven't done anything to stop its redevelopment, I would just make the assumption that it's still going to be positive for endo and just treat it.
I mean, I think it's just like anybody else that you're going to be like, do I do the test or do I just suppress? And granted, suppression isn't necessarily fun. I mean, taking Lupron or Alyssa, it's essentially being menopausal for a couple months. Sometimes people can have some mood disturbances and things like that. So it's not the same level as just saying, hey, be on birth control pills for a couple of months. And so I think that's kind of a case by case, weighing it and see what you want to do. Some people would rather take the chance of doing the Receptiva test in the hope that they spent 1 month doing Receptiva and they get to skip that other month that they would have had to be on suppression for another month.
Yeah.
All right. I am 27 years old. My husband is also 27. We've been trying to conceive for a little over a year with no luck. I have suspected endometriosis, and my husband has a semen analysis come back as 400,000 sperm count and 10% motility. What are our chances of conceiving naturally without IVF, and would IVF even work with his results?
So IVF would definitely work if he has any sperm. If you have 10 eggs and he has 10 sperm that move, IVF will work in theory. So it sounds like that may be obviously more the issue, even though you thought you had endometriosis. And I don't know, did she mention what her symptoms were or why she thought she had endometriosis?
Yeah, she just suspected. So I'm kind of guessing she has pelvic pain.
Yeah. So it sounds like a male issue. I mean, you certainly could have endometriosis, but based on his sperm count, it sounds like, you know, obviously he should see a urologist and be checked out. If his sperm count is not able to be improved, then IVF would kind of be the option for you. And if IVF is the option for you, then I wouldn't do laparoscopy to look for endometriosis at that point.
Yeah, it's one of the main reasons for laparoscopy is if you are having a ton of pain, because otherwise, a lot of times we defer to using Lupron or Ulissa because that can hit all the disease, whereas laparoscopy is not necessarily going to hit the microscopic disease because you can't see it. And so, you know, I think you're heading towards IVF one way or the other, given that sperm count. And so you might as well streamline it and take advantage of the medications that you can take rather than getting operated on, unless you have significant pain or something else that you've got a compelling reason to say, oh, let's go to the surgery first.
All right. I completely agree.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
Hi, I'm 32 years old, and it was recently to found a large 10 by 8 by 6 centimeter endometrioma on my left ovary, confirmed by MRI. My AMH was 2.11, FSH 6.78. Husband and I have not tried to conceive yet, but would like to start within the next year. I'm nervous about having surgery to remove the endometrioma, particularly about the effects to the ovary reserve, scar tissue, and potential drops of AMH I have read about. Should I need to pursue IVF in the future? I've read about the chances of torsion and rupture, but it seems like the risk is relatively low. I've also read about the possibility for endometriomas to naturally decrease in size with pregnancy. I am hoping you could provide me with some further insights and guidance. Thank you. This is a very well-educated individual.
Yeah, I think it's a personal decision for patients and physicians. I can tell you, having operated on big endometriomas before, I would tell you this needs to come out. And I'm a pretty conservative person. I don't jump right into surgery, but this is a big endometrioma. It's not small. And quite frankly, I agree your AMH is good, but I think a lot of your AMH number is coming from your good ovary. I'm just concerned that what the damage to your ovary has already been done because it's been so stretched out that probably has damaged some of those eggs. You may or may not be able to keep that ovary, but what's left of your ovary is going to be pretty small because, you know, the ovary stretches around this huge mass and the doctor cuts into it and has to bring the mass out. I just don't think I would want to be walking around with a 9 centimeter large endometrioma because I don't think torsion is an issue. Usually the ovary's stuck and it doesn't really move. So I don't know that that's big of an issue, but I would worry about rupture in the middle of the night and having some stranger operate on me emergently. And pretty certain you wouldn't keep your ovary if it was an emergency surgery in the middle of the night. Whereas if it's, you know, in a more controlled environment, some surgeons will do it robotically. I think there's a reasonable chance that you could salvage whatever's left of that ovary, but I just don't think that ovary's in great shape right now anyway. I don't think you're going to do a whole lot more damage to what's there. And I think I would worry much more about ruptured ovary in the middle of the night, having to have emergent surgery.
I would also be worried about, let's say you decided to keep it and you end up needing to do IVF. Like, I think distortion wise, you're probably not in a good position to get any eggs naturally releasing from that ovary and getting picked up from the tube. I mean, it can always happen. Anything can happen, but it seems a lot less likely that that would happen. And when we're going in to get eggs, let's say you do need to have IVF, we're not going to puncture that's endometrioma if we can at all avoid it. And so that means that we very likely may jettison anything on that left ovary because that endometrioma is just so big that it's going to make it really hard to access any follicles that are growing without puncturing it. And sometimes you get lucky and and you've got a follicle growing on the closer side so you can access it. But a lot of the times, like, you just don't want to go there, because if we poke a hole in that with our needle, that's a blood auger plate. Like, that is a setup for getting an infection in your pelvis.
That's going to be a big, bad, you're in the hospital for weeks infection.
Yeah.
Like, that is way worse. So I would probably opt for finding a surgeon who's super used to dealing with endo, getting someone who rarely has to take out ovaries because their skill level is good enough. They know when to keep going and when to stop and how to get cysts out without as much damage. But I think you're probably heading towards taking it out.
Yeah, I would definitely say this is something you want to go to in somebody who does a lot of endometriosis surgeries. Okay. This is not probably something. I mean, I have like one general OB-GYN, but he's like a robotics master that I would send to something like this. But generally you want a reproductive endocrinologist or a minimally invasive surgeon who just does a lot of super, super complex surgeries and not simple stuff.
Yeah. This is where recommendations make a huge amount of difference, because your doc is going to know who does this all the time and who they're willing to send to and who they very politely may say, well, why don't you go try this other doc? Go talk to them.
And I think this ovary can be salvaged. I really do. I think it has to be the skill level of the surgeon. And, you know, even that ovary is never going to be the same size as your other ovary, most likely. But even if just a portion of it's salvaged, I still think you'll be able to get some eggs out of it. And I think it's better to do it before you do IVF, so that, like Carrie said, you know, hopefully, even if there's just a small amount of ovary there, they'll be able to get to all the follicles that are able to arise from what's left from that ovary.
Okay, let's do one more. Episode with Bruce, the implantation expert, you talked about Lupron, but I was surprised that excision surgery didn't come up. My doctor gave me the choice of Lupron or excision surgery and said that the two interventions had similar success, with surgery slightly higher and allowing for natural cycle FET, making surgery her recommendation. Does the fact that the expert never even mentioned excision surgery as an option mean that taking that path instead of 2 months of Lupron after positive Receptiva tests mean I'm putting my only embryo at risk by not going the Lupron route?
That's a really good question. So there's a couple things to consider anytime you're considering surgery. Primarily that these surgeries are complex, they are hard to do, and finding surgeons who are really good at them is not always easy, especially if you are not in a big city where there's every kind of specialty you could ever imagine. And so particularly if you are in a slightly smaller space, traveling for surgery is harder. That typically makes Lupron the win, because you can do a lot of damage with these surgeries for someone who's not used to doing it, and the risk of complications is higher. For someone who does it all the time, the risk of complication is a lot lower, because this is what they eat, sleep, and breathe. And so they're really good at it. And so I think that's one thing to consider about why he may have skipped over a lot of the surgical questions. Although,
and you know, I have a question for you guys. So, like, we know who are good surgeons to do things like this, because this is our world. But if you were outside of this world, like, even if I went to have surgery on, like, my heart, other than, like, calling a few people that I know, like, how would you suggest somebody go figure out who actually is a good surgeon? I mean, that's a hard question to answer, because I'm like,
well, yeah. I mean, you have to have some connection to somebody in the community that knows. I mean, that's really the key, because
you can't go by Google reviews, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. That is a great point, because one of the people around here that's not in this field but advertises quite a lot in the newspaper and on TV, and this person was operating in a surgery center where I was operating on, and I'm like, hey, would you ever go to this doctor for da da da, what his specialty is? And they're like, well, he's a really good dancer. That was the reply. So that kind of tells you all you need to know. So just because you can use Google reviews, don't necessarily believe them. You really need to have somebody, either somebody that knows somebody or a doctor or somebody that can give you the inside scoop, because there's just really no way for you to know it yourself.
I would think one way to get that is you go to somebody to get the recommendation who works a lot with the adjacent population, but who doesn't do surgery themselves. So for example, you go to a cardiologist. If you're asking about heart surgery, you go to a cardiologist.
That's a good idea.
Who sees the complex patients, and you say, who would you get your surgery done by.
Right.
And
that's the answer right there.
And that's how you go about that, because it means they cannot answer themselves, because that's not their specialty. That's not their skill set, but they deal with that world a lot. So for endometriosis, you think about maybe the chronic pain people. You think about the general gynecologists who no longer operate. You think about the people who are, you know, either mid-career has advantages, because those people have usually been in that area long enough to know the new... Who does what good and who's new coming out, because they've seen all the trainees. A lot of times the trainees really know, because they're operating with everybody. And so you go to a university clinic and you see a resident and you say, okay, I need to have the surgery. Who's the best in town? And they're going to know, at least in the university system, who's going to be the best, because they will have watched how everything plays out.
That's like when I have patients that are OB patients that happen to be moving really early, right when they just found out they're pregnant. I always tell them when you go to a new town, just call labor and delivery at the hospital and go, hey, can I speak to one of the nurses in labor and delivery? And go, hey, I'm new to town. You know, who would you recommend? And, you know, usually you get a good recommendation because they've worked with those doctors in labor and delivery and they know who's good and who's not.
Yeah. You could probably do the same thing by talking to the OR control desk.
You might. Actually, that might not be a bad idea, actually. Yeah.
Or if you know anybody in anesthesia who's connected to the anesthesia world.
That's who I always ask whenever I have a family member who needs surgery. I'm like, hey, who do you know that's a good hand surgeon or a good whatever? I always ask anesthesia because they know everything.
They know.
They're in the room.
Yep.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Cool. Well, to all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us this week, and be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review. We would love to hear from you. You can do Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Facebook or YouTube or Instagram or any of the places where communication happens. So hop on by and leave us a like or a follow and say hello.
And you can also visit us on fertility.suncensored.com to submit specific questions. All questions will be answered on our podcast anonymously, just like we did today for our Ask the Doc segment or for question segments like this one. Leave us an episode idea. We'd love to hear from you. Don't hold back.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for two plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.